This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with Howard Wilkinson. And Howard, you recently had a chance to interview a very fascinating local veteran from Cincinnati, Robert Doolin.
Yes.
Tell us about him.
Robert Doolin is an absolutely amazing man. On March 21st, he turns 100 years old. He was a POW during World War II. Shot down a navigator on a B-17, shot down over Holland. And he went to St. Xavier High School, grew up in Price Hill. And he came back after the war, got married, had three children, had a great life. And he tells the story. It was the easiest interview I ever had to do, Mark, because all I had to do was just ask basically one question, and
he still has very clear, vivid recollections of all
clear
this.
Clear as a bell, can remember everything that happened to him in those 16 months of captivity, as you're going to hear.
And he turns 100 this month.
On March 21st.
Well, let's hear the interview that Howard did with Robert Doolin.
Mr. Doolin, you were born just on the eve of the U.S. entering World War One.
Right.
In March of 1917.
On Poplar Street.
Poplar Street in the West End.
Yes.
Yeah, and you went from Poplar Street to St. Xavier High School. Tell me how you got from St. X High School into the military.
I was 10 years old when Lindbergh flew from New York to Paris, and from that day I wanted to fly more than anything else. August the 20th, 1941, I went to pilot school in Tulare, California. I was in heaven. I was flying every other day. I was in sunny California. And I learned to fly reasonably well, single engine.
Yeah.
But the end of the first course is 10 weeks, and I couldn't make the cut. So I came home. This was peacetime. And then December 7th, we had Pearl Harbor. After the new year, I re-enlisted, and in March 43, I went back in the Army and went to navigation school at Monroe, Louisiana. Graduated December 26, 1943, as second lieutenant navigator. I was assigned to a 10-man B-17 crew, and we started practicing.
And when were you shipped out? When were you?
April 26th. We had orders overseas, started flying with the 92nd Bomb Group in England.
And how many missions did you fly?
I completed 12. 13 was my nemesis.
13 was not your lucky number.
Right.
Tell me about that day. When did that happen?
Well, we were a high group. We were flying at 29,000 feet. And as soon as you leave England, when you get over the continent, just cross the North Sea, the fighters come in on you. And one of them knocked out our number 4 engine. We could still fly. But over the target in the Ruhr Valley, a town called Gelsenkirchen, the anti-aircraft just tore the bottom out of our ship. We're still flying, but I got just 3 small wounds, one in my spine and 2 in my hip, but just little pieces of flak. But the 5 men in the back were all injured seriously. The pilot put the plane in a dive. The men back there thought the ship was going down, so the 2 waist gunners jumped. Then the ball turret man saw them. He jumped. And then the radio operator and another jumped, leaving 1 man back there. We leveled out at 100 feet. The fighters can't fight at you,
shoot at you very well. That's right, yeah.
And we started home, and we've got 2 ME-109 fighter pilots flying formation with us. They were so close, I could see the helmet on this man's head. We became bosom buddies. We flew that way over an hour, headed back toward England. And finally, the pilot asked me how long to England, and I told him. He said, we don't have enough gas. So we crash-landed in Holland. We got out of the airplane. I had to leave the 5th man there because he was going into shock. I pointed south and said, Spain is that way. Start walking. And we did. Broke into 2 groups, 3 men and 2 men. We got shut down at 9:30 in the morning. We walked all day till almost dusk. And the three of us are waiting in a little grove of trees, you know, like a movie. A man comes walking up pushing a bicycle. He makes a V sign, and I try to help him.
And these were underground
people. These were resistance, yes. Resistance. Underground people. Resistance. Yeah, yes. The bravest people you'll ever know.
Yes.
But anyway, we walked to his house and stayed there overnight, and he gave us civilian clothing. Then the next morning, we started in a car. We went south some distance to a farmhouse. And we stayed there with a farmer, his wife, and two children, maybe 8 and 10.
It was a safe house.
Yes.
Yes.
But we stayed there, and I don't know, a week later or so, the pilot was taken on. And another 4 or 5 days, my co-pilot and I got a guide, and we went on. First night, we were walking south, or going south, and we stayed in a house in a little town called Roermond, R-O-E-R-M-O-N-D. And the next day, we got a guide came and was going to take us into Belgium. Now, we got shot down August 12th. It's now September 1st.
This is 1943.
So we get on a two-day train ride back up to The Hague and a trolley car out into the suburbs. And we were, the first man would walk about 150 feet ahead. So if he were stopped, the next one could go into an alley or you know, so he wouldn't get caught. I was first. I walked up on his porch and just touched the door. And in an instant, the door was open. I was inside. I had four men all over me. One man hit me on the head. And as I didn't go out, but I went down, and I could see he had an insignia of a skull on his head. The second man's got a gag in my mouth. The third one has me handcuffed. The fourth pushes me to the floor. A co-pilot got the same treatment. They hustled us into two cars.
And you were a prisoner.
I was the Gestapo.
Yeah.
We rushed into a federal prison in Scheveningen, a little suburb of The Hague. And you've heard the drill, name rank.
Yes.
Second Lieutenant Robert Doolin, 0795218, Second Lieutenant Army Air Corps. They took my shoes away. They took my belt. They took a metal rosary I had. I managed to keep a little bar of soap with a little compass embedded in it.
Is that right?
But every time they questioned you for 5 minutes, and then you stand for a half an hour with a gun at your back. Finally, they ushered me into a room about this big and a big picture of Hitler on the wall. And I stand there, and then finally the door opens, and a Gestapo man came in. He walks right past me, Heil Hitler to the picture. Lieutenant Doolin, is this the new United States Army uniform? And we went around like that for 2 hours. Didn't ask me a single military question. All he wanted to know was who helped me and where we'd been. I didn't know.
He wanted to know about the underground, the resistance.
Right. He didn't give a darn about the military.
Yeah.
But we stayed there for quite a few days. But the first night at dusk, I heard someone whistle Bob Hope's theme song, Thanks for the Memory. And instantly there's hubbub out in the corridor. We found out that this was the old Dutch federal prison, and all the other prisoners, there were about 120 of them, were all Dutch families, men, women, children, all Jewish families, on their way to Bergen-Belsen to be killed. Let's see the courage of these people that have the guts to have use Bob Hope's theme song for a signal that now the guard was gone from the corridor, you can talk.
That's amazing. What kind of courage.
I found out my co-pilot was in a cell right next to me. And he turned us over to the Luftwaffe. We're running prison camps for airmen, thank God. In World War I, there had been a certain mystique between American pilots and German pilots. Some of that still existed, and some of our guards had been flying in World War I.
Right.
So they took us all the way over to the Polish border to a camp called Stalag Luft III.
Which became a very famous camp.
It's a great movie, The Great Escape.
Yes.
Because it's not only a great movie, but it's true, except for in order to get Steve McQueen to do the movie, he had to ride his motorcycle. Never happened.
Never happened, yeah.
But all the rest of it happened, not in the same time sequence.
How long were you there?
I was there from October 1st, 43, until January 24th, 45, 16 months.
What were conditions like in that camp?
If I were to talk to someone who is a Japanese prisoner, they would say, you weren't in a prison camp, you were in a country club.
Mm-hmm.
And while we complained a lot and we were sometimes cold and a little hungry, we were never emaciated. We could always get warm if we stayed in bed. We were allowed to have books. The YMCA sent us books, and we could get other books. The Red Cross, of course, was the main thing. They brought food in to a scale that's impossible to believe. They had a package, half a cubic foot, 12 inch by 12 inch by 6. 7 pounds of food was designed to be full food for one man for 7 days for a week. We never got one a week, but we get sometimes get one every 10 days to 2 weeks. It had 12 ounces of Spam, 12 ounces of corned beef, pound of powdered milk, pound of margarine, 8 ounces of sugar, 4 ounces maybe of instant coffee, sometimes juice, and 5 packs of American cigarettes. Yeah. American cigarettes to this day are currency anywhere.
Yeah.
The YMCA sent us footballs, soccer balls, baseballs. We were allowed to clear a field, play. Now, if we wrote a letter home, we said we were cold or hungry, they wouldn't mail that letter or they'd X it out. So we wrote home, I learned to cook today. We sat by the pool and sunbathed today. And so we started getting criticism. You know, we were allowed to have a theater. The YMCA sent us musical instruments. We had some people who were musicians.
Were you able to communicate with people back home, folks back home?
As a second lieutenant, I was allowed to send 3 letters and 4 postcards a month. I could get as much mail as I think I got more mail than anyone else in the camp. There were actually men there that hardly got a letter. But, yeah, we could get, and we knew exactly what was going on. We had the German radio, we had the German newspapers, which reported every day.
Yes.
And we had a secret radio to get BBC, had some broadcasts.
Is that right? You could get BBC broadcasts.
Yeah. When I was shot down, I was prisoner number 2555, 2555. Most of the camp men were British, RAF, which Canadian, New Zealand, English, but... God, the Americans are now getting more groups coming over. There are more Americans than there are English. Then came D-Day, crossing of the Rhine. Then the bloodiest battle the Americans had from December 16th, 44 to January 21st,
45. Right. But you were aware of all of this going on.
We're aware of all this. Yes, sir. November, we didn't have any Red Cross parcels. We were hungry. I mean, you'd wake up in the middle of the night and your mouth is watering and they had been talking about flying and girls and travel and girls. And from then on, all you could talk about was food. We got Red Cross food in the end of November. Thousands of packages. Because by this time, we have 10,000 prisoners there.
Yeah.
One camp. Imagine 10,000 slices of bread.
Yeah.
That was the mainstay of the German ration. And it looked like it had wood in it. I think it was just all of the whole grain. Black. A loaf of bread weighed 5 pounds. But each barracks had a little 4-man coal-fired stove to cook on for 50 men. And if you put that bread on that hot stovetop, it became quite palatable. January, now there's a lot of rumors. Now the rumor is that Germans are going to kill us all. Well, it was more than a rumor. Hitler had ordered all those Luft gangsters killed. Fortunately, saner heads prevailed there. The second rumor was the Germans are going to just pull up and abandon us to the Russians, which we didn't want.
Which, you didn't want
and
that.
The third rumor was they're going to walk us out of here. How can you walk 10,000 men?
But that's what happened.
But by golly, January 25th, they came in and told men you had to be ready to be able to move in 2 hours, which we knew was impossible. Our senior American officer was Colonel Delmar T. Spivey. He was shot down with us. The finest man anyone ever served under. He kept in touch with us until he died, years later. They came into Spivey, and we had a general, and he says, we have a railroad car for you. And Spivey says, if my men walk, I walk. So we were the third camp to start walking west. It was about 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and there was a good 6 inches of snow on the ground. So 10,000 men, we walked 5 days, we walked 54 miles to a town called Spremberg, which is a train junction. And we put us on 40 and 8, the old 40 men, 8 horses from World War I. They put 40 men in there, sometimes 45, and a German guard in a cardboard box for a bathroom. I felt better walking than I did in that damn car. We were 3 days in that. We finally got to Munich and then took a little electric engine about 30 miles away to a town called Moosburg, Moosburg. Stalag 7A. This was run by the Gestapo. Now, this was not...
That was not a very pleasant place.
The first night we were there, they said, we don't have barracks for you. So they put us, we call it the snake pit. It had no paved floor. And lice and fleas like you'd never seen before. We were in there 2 days. And they got us into a barracks. And they were dry. They were not heated. We had 12 men bunk beds, two wide, three deep, and three tiers. Food was not too good. We were counted twice a day. Eventually, though, they had now 100,000 prisoners, one camp, with no facilities for except old small outhouses.
Was it built for that many? Or was
no.
It, yeah.
No. Eventually, it got so bad that there was excrement and urine overflowing out, and even to where we were had to line up to be counted twice a day. At this time, Rojo Goodwitz was a senior officer, and he said, short of violence, they don't count us today. So we would not line up. We didn't line up in orderly rows. And they brought the damn dogs and the machine guns in again, and it was hairy, but they finally said, we'll do something. So they did. They dug big slit trenches about 2 feet wide.
Yeah.
A long frame up here to lean on. It was that way then until April 29th. We know what's going on. We know that Patton's getting close. The Russians are coming from the east. At about 10:30 in the morning, we hear cannon fire. Oh, we heard cannon fire the night before. Tanks come bursting through the barbed wire fence. And it's the 3rd Army, 99th Infantry.
How did that make you feel?
We had men bend down and kiss the ground.
Yeah.
Because we had some Englishmen there who had been prisoners for 3 or 4 years.
Right.
Patton came in the next day. He didn't have much of a voice. But he says, I know you think I'm going to get you out of here. And here's where it varies. I didn't hear him say this. But he said, but I have Germans to kill. And a date with a Fraulein, but he did get us a GI bakery some way, and he baked bread. By this time, there were 20,000 Russians, about 15,000 Poles. They thought it was cake. Most of it, we stayed there from April 29th to May the 8th, VE Day.
Yeah.
And Eisenhower sent a fleet of trucks in, 6x6 trucks, drove about 30 miles to Straubing on the Danube. God, a beautiful bird, a C-47, a Goonie bird. Actually, it was a Douglas 1930s airliner, but we used them even in Nam.
Yeah.
Just a lovely airplane to fly. It's
there must have been quite a sight, though, to see.
Oh, God, it was. They were flying the Americans out. The British had to get their own people out. They flew us to Le Havre, France, and... we got a clean uniform. We got an apple and an orange. And the first thing they did was examine us for venereal disease. I don't know where they figured we would get it, but we could write home from there again. We were there a couple of weeks. And finally, we got on a ship out of Le Havre for New York. And now, in the prison camp, we had known what was going on in the States because we had the radio, first of all. We also had... more and more groups are coming from America each month, so we would get fellas maybe shot down on their first mission. They might have been in the States 10 days, 12, so we knew all about the singers and the girls and everything. We get out to sea, and I bought a box of 25 cigars and 20 Hershey bars the first day. I ate all of them the first day.
Is that right?
Hershey bars.
I don't blame you. I can't blame you.
We're out to sea, and the captain gets on the thing. I know you think we're going to New York, but I've got cargo here for Port of Spain, Trinidad. Well, we heard about working for the Yankee dollar, rum and coca. And he gets on the, when we get to Trinidad, we pull into Port of Spain in the harbor, and we're sitting there, and he says, if you think I'm going to turn 1,000 ex-POWs loose in Port of Spain. So we had to sit on that ship.
Yeah.
And
He wouldn't let you out.
You know, I'm eating twice a day. Because I went from 135 to, I guess, 165. Not right there. We sailed back and landed in New York June the 5th, 45.
Yeah.
Got off the ship, Red Cross or YMCA girl met us each with a pint of milk, and we stayed overnight in New Jersey. I think it was Camp Shanks. Took a train to Atterbury in New York, in Indianapolis, and I saw my first WAC. They didn't have them when I went overseas. She was the most efficient Army officer I ever saw. She was a captain. She's a paymaster.
Yeah.
Well, we all had a couple of years pay, you know, and these their guys are growing $1,000. I went up and I says, I just took $100. She said, you can draw it. I said, look, he's minded her buying, getting drawn $1,000 are all also buying playing cards. When I get off, I only have 100 miles to go to Cincinnati. When I get off right. the train, I'll still have my $100.
So yeah, I did. You didn't have far to go. Yeah.
No, and so I was on rest and recuperation then the rest of the summer.
Right. And you were reunited with your
family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had met a girl in Salina, Kansas in March 43, and a nice girl, it was casual.
Yeah.
I wrote to her while I was in a prison camp. I also wrote to a girl I had been dating for 6 years, too. I don't think I better say that for the public.
Okay.
No, I mean, things happen.
Yeah.
But after I got clean uniform, I took a train out to Kansas, where I had met her, and we had a couple of dates, and I came back to Cincinnati, and we corresponded, and I went back again, and I find her, I brought her to meet my mother, and then that summer of 45, I got orders to report to Boca Raton, Florida. I said, oh, daggone, that's a luxury hotel. The 2 days before I was to leave, I got a telegram, do not report to Boca Raton. Now, report to San Antonio, Texas, to the big air base there.
Yeah.
And I wanted to fly. We didn't have enough gasoline for us to get airplanes to fly at this the big air base.
Yeah.
Finally got one flight from San Antonio to Georgia and back. And that was the only flying I could get. I had been thinking about staying in, and I said, if it's going to be like this, I'll go home. So I went home in October 45.
And you ended up marrying that girl from Kansas.
I went out after I got back, still in the Army, because I had never had a leave.
Yeah.
What they have is terminal leave. You get paid for all of those.
Right.
You're still in the Army, but you're home.
Sure.
And so I went out there and visited her, and I brought her to Cincinnati, and we got married November 17th, 1945.
WVXU's Howard Wilkinson speaking with Cincinnati World War II veteran Robert Doolin, who celebrates his 100th birthday this month. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at wvxu.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Josh Elstro was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney.